This is Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello, and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, Blood on the Snow, The Dark Tales of Christmas.
Ah, 'tis the season to be jolly, Jules.
'Tis the season to be murdered, more like.
It is indeed. Seasons of ghosts and ghouls and death riding in on his pale horse.
You know, normally I think we bring a little bit of darkness to Christmas anyway. I'm just thinking about some of our past Christmas episodes. We've talked about the tradition of ghost stories. We've talked about what carols really mean.
Yeah. It's been scary. It's been sexy. You know, we've covered the basics there.
We've covered the basics. But the one thing we haven't really covered is the association between Yule or Christmas and death. And it's a big one.
Yeah.
And it has its origins in sort of, well, Christmas has its origins in some very dark places.
It certainly does. And we understand that our listeners come to this podcast because they want this kind of content. Yes. Nothing really starts Christmas off quite like a Dissecting Dragons episode all about how awful Christmas truly is.
Yeah, assuming that you want something slightly more saccharine than ritual murder, then perhaps you want to try something else.
However,
another podcast. However, if this is what you're here for.
If you're down for some spooky tales, you're definitely in the right place.
Yeah. This is basically, these are less sort of spooky tales and more about, these are practices based on myths, legends and you know, pagan understandings and things.
Mm.
And they're even continued in some form today. Not the actual ritual murder side of things, hopefully.
Hopefully.
But it's really interesting, in my opinion, to look at the origins of these stories and look at how Christmas has sort of taken them on board and really given them a facelift.
Yes.
Made them more palatable.
Yeah. My favourite thing is, of course, we have all these sort of like innocent little traditions that you see and you're like, oh, how fun, how cute. How nice. And then you sort of look at the origin and you're like, oh, yep, there we go. There's the murder. That's what I was looking for. That's what I was waiting on.
Basically, if there's a tradition that seems to go back a long way and you can't really think of a real reason why it would have its roots in a particular religious practice or an organised religious practice now, then there's a good chance it's something to do with sex or death.
Mm-hmm.
That's usually a pretty good guiding principle.
Yeah. If in doubt.
If in doubt. So, as we've mentioned before, the big Celtic fire festivals, so the winter solstice, the summer solstice, Beltane and Samhain are all about sex and death.
Yeah.
So are the smaller fire festivals, actually. In fact, you know, the Celts were big on sex and death, you know. And that's still reflected in carols and Christmas stories to this day. So even the sweet, heartwarming things that you sing and you watch and you tell your children, chances are they started somewhere very dark.
Yeah, the Celts knew how to throw a party, yeah, let's just say.
Okay, so we're going to go through some varying traditions and things and tell you where they're really from.
Yes.
And we're going to start off with the Wren Hunt, or Hunting the Wren.
Now, this one, the first time I heard about it was actually sound completely wrong, but Jules sure knows how to tickle me. It sounded even more wrong when I like instinct when in her writing. And the Wren Hunt is one of those ones that just feels so deliciously dark in so many ways, and you know, awful when you think about it in a real life context, but great in fiction.
Yeah, it was one I particularly liked, and I obviously found a good use for it in one of my Harker and Blackthorne books. I did. So let's look at the two sources. The idea of the Wren Hunt, or Hunting the Wren, is that on Boxing Day, or the 26th of December, the Feast of Stephen, you would you know, certain groups would go and hunt for a wren in the woods. And once they'd finally captured one and killed it, it would then get paraded on either a decorated holly tree or a long pole. And those who'd captured the wren would go from house to house in a sort of kind of like a wassail, but, you know, we've captured the wren, the king of all birds, etc., etc., etc. And this was... It, when you say it, that's kind of like, that's a really weird Christmas tradition, and the poor bloody wren kind of thing. There's a sort of Celtic pre-Christian type legend, as Madeline was saying, about there was a god, you know, if you listen to the Christian version, it's God wanted to know who of all the birds could fly the highest. And if you listen to the pagan version, it's like there was a competition among the birds, God wasn't really involved. So the idea was that all the birds would fly as high as they could, and whoever was the winner would be the king of the birds. And the eagle managed to get incredibly high, but the tricky wren had managed to hide itself on the eagle's back. It waited till the eagle had got as high as possible, and then launched itself off the eagle's back and flew just slightly higher than the eagle. So it won its crown by trickery.
Which is just 10 out of 10. A lot of sort of pagan and Norse, you know, myths are all about winning things, and Greek ones are all about winning things via trickery.
Yeah. Although the feel of that tale is that all the birds then disliked the wren for doing this, and you know, it was in a lot of trouble. There's the actual the wren hunt, where particularly you get young boys of the village, and this is still done in Ireland. They're dressed up in old clothes and they blacken their faces with coal and they wear straw hats and things, and they go hunting the wren. Sometimes they wear these great big wren hoods and things, which look terrifying. They do parade the wren around, but they don't actually kill one. They've just got an old stuffed wren that gets paraded around on a pole, which, you know, is still kind of macabre if you ask me. But it comes from two different sources. Now, one of them is obviously Saint Stephen, who was basically, he's the patron saint of martyrs, as well as other things. But he was the first real Christian martyr, the proto-martyr, if you will. And the idea was he was hiding from enemies in some bushes and a wren started twittering and gave him away. So therefore it's okay to hunt a wren on the Feast of Stephen. She's like, okay, so forevermore, one wren is kind of like, what the hell are you doing near my bloody nest? Piss off. Accidentally gives St. Stephen up. And apparently it's okay to then slaughter them on Boxing Day forevermore afterwards.
That's just rather cruel, really. It's just a wren being a wren.
Yes, that is rather cruel. The other one is the story of Tehi Tegi, who was a beautiful she-woman. And this is a Manx story from the Isle of Man. On the Feast of Stephen, Boxing Day, once again, Tehi Tegi stepped out across the island, and all the men who saw her fell instantly in love, whether they had wives or not. And she was the most beautiful thing they'd ever seen. And they just left their work. They left everything where it was. No matter what they were doing, they just abandoned it to follow her. And she sort of smiled at them and they trailed behind her. And it was kind of like the Pied Piper of Hamelin, except it was all the, you know, it was all the men.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, she got as far as a river. And being a she-woman, she told the waters to part and led her across. So she crossed the ford. And the men just eagerly followed her into what would have been the ford. And as soon as enough of them were in the river, she relaxed her hold on the spell. The water came in and drowned them all.
Hooray!
The few who'd managed not to go into the river, and all the women who by that point were extremely pissed off, were sort of not happy about this for obvious reasons.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly as she stood on the other side of the bank and just sort of laughed at them. And they were going to hunt her, so she turned herself into a wren and escaped. And after that, it's on the Feast of Stephen, you hunt the wrens that you see.
Mm. Okay.
But again, this is a clearly... Okay, I mean, this is a very typical sort of Irish fairy tale. But you're looking at the winter solstice type time period.
Yeah.
And a huge sacrifice, a huge loss of life. A huge loss of male life. That's the thing. People talk about sacrificing virgins and maidens and things, and actually it very rarely is. It's usually young men. Or men of a certain physical ability.
Sorry. No.
Mass ritual. Yeah, and it's not like she was being subtle about it. It's a bit hard on the poor old wren, that it should then be hunted once again forevermore. Mm-hmm. So whichever route you decide to go for the origins of this story, it's still very dark, and it gets darker still. The wren, because the wren is considered the bird of winter, it sings all the way through the winter as well as the summer, and it's for a very small brown bird that's quite unremarkable looking in a lot of ways. It's got a very beautiful song, very big song for its size. It was considered the bird of winter. It was also associated with the old year. So the robin was associated with the new year. The robin with its red breast represented the sun being reborn. So you killed the wren in order to make way for the robin for the summer.
Ah, hooray!
So, yes, that's not great. Anyway, at one point, these wren hunts were done not just with wrens, but with poor, unfortunate women who were sent off in brown clothing into the woods, and then the young men were sent after to hunt them. Now, in fairness, sometimes this was a way of getting around, you know, having sex out of marriage without any penalty, because mm-hmm. if you caught a wren, then that's generally what was happening. But in some instances, because any sort of ritual is subject to abuse, it was a case of these were powerless women who had no male protectors who were told to run. And, you know, you obviously had to run. And it was kind of an excuse for that sort of carousing and merrymaking at the expense of someone else. And, you know, there's even a few documents and things which suggest that a couple of these women kind of who did get caught then ended up being forced to be prostitutes because obviously nobody would marry them after that.
Yeah. Which is awful.
So, yes. and you can find it in folk songs as well, how the women are quite often linked to being wrens. Now, some of this is to do with the Shay story about the sorceress who turned into a wren and the wren being a trickster. And sometimes it's about being the wren being a very, very small bird with a sweet song mm-hmm. that's easily broken. So it's very dark and quite horrific.
That is just really, really sad.
And that's the thing that we will talk about here, because when we're talking about winter being a time of sacrifice, yes, it can mean literally blood on the snow, or it can mean the sacrifice of something else. It can mean the sacrifice of a dear possession, or it can mean the sacrifice of your innocence, or, you know, something else.
Yeah. And it's quite funny for me the way that things are so heavily associated with the seasons. And I think that one thing that we sort of forget about in the modern day is actually how, you know, with our central heating now, with our, you know, electricity and warm water and all of these kinds of things, it's really easy to forget how much we did used to live by the seasons. And why we have so many things and so many ideas which are, you know, tied to them so thoroughly.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, it's all sex and death. And as I've said, generally it's the males who get sacrificed en masse in terms of losing a life. But the women end up being sacrificed in a completely different way. Sometimes this is willing. That's the other thing. Sometimes these sacrifices are considered are done willingly. Sometimes they're kind of... sometimes they're done under duress, shall we say. And obviously it's not just violence against a person. It can be other things as well. We'll get into that. Okay, so... a little bit on seasonal monarchs. Again, this is another pagan Celtic tradition. Basically, the first half of the year, from the morning after the winter solstice all the way through to the summer solstice, it belongs to the Oak King. And the other half of the year belongs to the Holly King. So if the oak is an ascendant, then we're heading towards summer. If the holly is an ascendant, then we're heading towards midwinter. Neither one's really bad, but they are supposed to murder each other. They're brothers. They're supposed to murder each other at the turning points of the year. So during the winter solstice, the Oak King is supposed to murder the Holly King in order to take the crown, and conversely, when you get the king who's cut down with a corn sort of, or just before the summer solstice, before the real harvest, he is supposed to be murdered by the Holly King, who is again taking the crown.
It's,
it's again, you know, let's say it was murder, kind of.
It really is. I mean, obviously the idea is that somehow they're kind of reborn again, in some form or another. Or are they? Is it always a new Holly King? Is it always a new Oak King?
I think while the physical body might die, the actual essence, the spirit, is supposed to continue. Yeah. And obviously, if you tie it in with some of the other stories as well, then at the turning of the year, midwinter solstice, is also when the Sun King is supposed to be born. That's when the king of the new year is supposed to be born. And, you know, once it gets to...
That's very cool.
It really depends which set of stories you're going from. But they all have a very common root, and they're really old. In fact, I think they're pre-Celtic, or they have their origins pre-Celtic. Their origins are so old that we don't have a written record anymore. Yeah, but I also find it quite sinister, because it feels like, and I guess this is again something I've drawn on in book five, is the fact that this is a winter story, and it's happening, and it happens every year whether we pay any attention to it or not, and it will happen. And anything that gets in the way of it happening, playing out its role as a winter story, is going to get crushed under the weight of all those years of tradition.
I mean, it's one of those ideas, again, that really introduces the concept of necessary violence, if that makes sense. Now, that comes out wrong in me saying that violence is ever necessary. It's not that. It's that nature is a balance between life and death, and without death, life becomes impossible, because that's just the way that things work. And it's cruel, and it's visceral, and it's, you know, barbaric in a lot of ways, but it is the natural order of things. You cannot have summer without winter.
Yeah, it's a balance, as you say. And you absolutely need... I mean, if we're talking in sheer biological terms, plants need winter. They need that cold period in order for the seed to germinate. If you don't get a cold enough winter, a lot of plants then don't sprout the following year, because they need that cold point to start off the germination process. So, yes, and it is harsh. Nature is harsh and beautiful, and a lot of these stories sort of reflect that. And they've been prettied up quite a bit because, as you said just now, the way we live with electricity and heating and convenience, and we can make we can make day into night and night into day as it suits us, kind of thing. We don't live as close to the land or the seasons.
No, we don't. We don't have Jack Frost putting, you know, ferns on our...
Glad that struck you. Okay, so the whole idea of wholesale slaughter of men is not... I'm not advocating this, by the way. I've got a little aside there. I'm not saying this is something that we should bring back. It's time to put back murder in the centre of the Christmas story. This is not where I'm going with this. But the idea of it being an entirely pagan tradition is false, because... if you look at, obviously, the Abrahamic religions, the Christian tradition, let's talk about King Herod.
Well,
it's like, it is a Christmas story.
This is a Christmas story, but it's... King Herod is one of those really funny ones. And this is the other thing, is that the whole concept of King Herod, you see it in other stories as well. The idea of there being a child who's been born and a king has ordered the death of, you know, everybody in that, you know,
all the age children bracket.
Of baby, all the babies, basically. All the children of babies, what the hell am I talking about? All the babies of a certain age in order to get rid of this child in some form or another. It's like this very ancient story, which you find, I mean, it happens in the Arthurian legends, like Arthur himself did it, apparently.
I'm sure it turns up in Welsh and Irish legends as well.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure, you know, there's definitely a point where someone's gone, ooh, don't want that baby around. The only answer is to murder all the babies.
It's like, what happens is a prophet says, the new king will be born on X date, blah, blah, blah. He will be the greatest king ever. And being a prophet, he's obviously weirdly non-specific, so he doesn't tell you who the child is or exactly how old it is. But he just says it to a king, usually, just to put the shits up them.
Hey.
It's like, this person will be your downfall. And, you know, if you're a king and you've managed to hold on to your throne, there's a chance that you might just not be the nicest kind of person ever.
Yeah.
That you might just be the sort of person who would order the wholesale massacre of an entire age group so that no one takes you from your throne.
Exactly.
Which is obviously what happened with Herod.
Yeah.
Now, when I was a child at a Catholic primary school, we learned all the Stations of the Cross, and we were learning this one. You know, this is part of the... I think it was one of the Sorrowful Mysteries.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just kind of like, yes, and we're on the run up to Christmas, and yeah, we'll do the nativity scene, and there'll be a donkey and an ox and some sheep and some shepherds and some kings, etc. Oh, and by the way, over here there's Herod doing a red day kind of thing.
Yeah.
We're like, hang on, can we just go back to that thing over there, because that looks like an awful lot of people are dying.
No, children, move on.
It just sort of... They always felt they had to tell us that it was part of the Christmas story and then just gloss over it. So you were left there wondering why.
Yeah, that Jesus's birth was heralded by a massacre of infants. And again, this is just everywhere. I mean, you see the same with Moses, heralded, you know, bunch of dead children. It just sort of happens everywhere, and particularly in the Abrahamic myths as well.
Yes, definitely. It's kind of like a male child is born and will be king. Oh God, we better kill everyone under the age of three, kind of thing.
So
obviously they escaped this after Jesus's birth by going into Egypt.
Yeah.
In all actuality, they probably didn't actually go into Egypt. That's just the person who was writing down the Gospels at the time, which is obviously at least 100 years after the birth of the Messiah, used the Persia format because he didn't actually want to give away actual locations to the Romans, who weren't very friendly at that point in time. So it may not have been Egypt at all. It's just Egypt was a good call back to, obviously, as Madeline has just said, Moses. So it was using parallels in story. So it's all really interesting. The more you dig into it, the more interesting I think it is. What I find most interesting about this, aside from the fact that it's just horrific, and it's kind of like, yes, we're having a red Christmas, is that, you know, a lot of the whole Christian tradition managed to cement itself by borrowing, if I'm using a generous term, from other already established religions, and using a lot of their myths, legends, and the way things, you know, the way things were believed to happen. So this idea of, you know, wholesale slaughter of male infants and things fitted quite nicely for them in some of the pagan traditions, and certainly things like, in the same way that Jesus hanging on a cross fitted in quite nicely for them with Odin hanging on the world tree. And things like that. And it just let them slot Christianity in just that little bit more easily.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
And you've got to, you know, whatever you think about organised religion, again, I'm genuinely not having a pop at actual Christians, but just the whole process, the politics and the PR of it, you've kind of got to admire something that was done that slickly.
Yeah, but, you know, as we said in a previous episode, it's all on the surface.
it's all on the surface. And I guess that's the thing, isn't it? With all stories, you can choose to just take the surface meaning if that's all that you feel you can personally deal with.
Yeah.
Or you can dig a little bit deeper and find out the true horror underneath.
Yeah. Now, of course, the thing is that when stories are told enough times, they gain a power onto themselves. So even though we are kind of delving into the origins, there is nothing wrong with holding on to the version that you know and celebrate, because there's a truth in what you're sort of brought up with and what you truly, you know, if Christmas is about love and life and joy and things like that, you're not wrong. It isn't not about those things. Sorry, that came out very mixed. You know, it is about those things. It's just that we have the two sides of the story. And the way that things have changed and developed, in that we no longer practice most of these sort of things, or that we now do, you know, mockery versions of them, is a very positive thing. We are no longer practicing, you know, the wren hunts and things like that, the ritual sacrifice. Again, we hope. Don't know what's happening in individual households, but let's just hope that we're no longer doing that. But before we move on from Herod, I just do remember one scene from The Vicar of Dibley, which I want to mention.
Okay.
Where they do the Christmas nativity, right?
Yep.
And they've got, I can't remember the character's name, but he wanted to play God, but he's been made to play Herod. And he doesn't want to play Herod because Herod's the bad guy.
Oh, God, so yes. So, I remember which bit you mean now.
Yeah, so he's just there like, go forth and kill all the children. And, you know, then everyone's about to go on. He's just like, but kill them gently. He says, for I do love children very much. And then he hands out sweeties to like, all the children in the crowd.
Like, thank you, Herod. Like, thank you, Herod.
I love you, Herod, one of them says.
That's brilliant. Yeah, that was really, really funny. I must watch that again before Christmas. Okay, Christmas trees.
Sorry. Whenever I think about Christmas trees now, I will always remember this story. And for the life of me, I cannot even remember who it was from. I saw it on the internet somewhere, and I hope it's true, about this little girl who her class were all asked to write basically a Christmas story from the Christmas tree's perspective, basically.
Yeah.
And everyone else in the class wrote these beautiful stories about this tree being, you know, having lights put in it and how beautiful it felt and stuff like that. And this one girl completely misunderstood and wrote what was essentially this horror story about this tree being cut down and then decorated as it was slowly decaying, and watching these people sort of celebrated. And the thing I always think about is, like, this really ties in so much with that whole sacrificial side of things.
It really does. That's the thing, isn't it? This is, you know, you have archetypes where you know what something or someone is because it's such a huge part of the human psyche. I think you've got that with some of these practices. It's kind of like someone gets lost at sea, and yet part of you understands that the sea has to take things back. You know, if you're someone who lives near the sea, you kind of understand. You've taken it on by osmosis. You don't even know where some of these myths and legends have come from, but it's there.
Yeah.
So. Anyway, I hope nobody believes Christmas trees are Christian, because they're really not.
They're absolutely not, no.
And you can put a star on top if you want to, and you can put an angel on top, although we both know that it's not really an angel, it's actually a figurine of the goddess.
That's the thing, yeah, because they say, you know, you put a fairy on top, and I'm just there like, doesn't seem very Christmassy to me.
This sort of goes back, you know, there's lots of different origins for this, and there's a few saint stories as well. Basically, for example, there's Saint Boniface, who cut down Donner's Oak, which, you know, I think was a really shitty thing to do, because they were perfectly happy worshipping that oak tree until he came along and chopped it down. And apparently the wood was then turned into a church, just to add insult to injury. So a real up yours to the Norse gods there. There are other ones as well, where some saint has come along and found a group of ignorant but innocent peasants worshipping a tree. I think one was in France. And they were decorating it with ribbons and things towards midwinter. Mm-hmm. You know, they were making offerings to the tree. It's like, oh, no, you can't do that. So they cut down the tree and brought it inside and made it part of the midwinter celebration kind of thing. So there's a whole bunch of them. We have favour trees, you know, wishing trees, whereby you would tie a ribbon or a lock of your hair or something to the tree at specific times of the year in order to ask for something. If you were a woman and you were hoping to get pregnant and you hadn't managed to so far, then you might tie a lock of your hair and a lock of your husband's twined together to things like a hawthorn. So, you know, this is not unusual, but the very specific Christmas trees are usually evergreens, because obviously they don't shed their leaves during the winter. And one evergreen tree that people don't tend to cut down and bring in as a Christmas tree is a yew. Now, the interesting thing about yews is as they grow, they become hollow, because the way the trunks form creates a hollow space in the middle. This is partly how they conserve water and they can grow pretty high. And the trunk then comes back together. So a lot of old yews are in fact hollow. And sometimes they're hollow in a way that you can actually get in. When I was at the convent in the junior school, we had a couple of trees like that. And we used to play actually inside the yews at lunchtime. They were very, very cool. They were kind of like little houses and or what have you. And that's great. But the more sinister thing is that people used to be sealed up inside yew trees as a sacrifice. So they'd be sealed up alive and either then burned or left to starve. And again, it was an offering to the wood as a whole kind of thing. Sometimes, sacrifice to, you know, the giving of a favour to a tree in order to attain something in the next year, something that your heart desires. Sometimes that offering would be blood. So it could be the blood of an animal. Perhaps you're scattering some blood from your hand. Or in rare instances, it might be the blood of an entire person, another willing ritual murder. We put shiny things on Christmas trees and it looks pretty. We put lights on them. I mean, the whole candle thing, I think, goes back to the 17th century. So, you know, it's comparatively recent. I've always thought candles on a tree that's full of sap is actually quite dangerous, personally. But
yeah, I do think that electric lights do make a big difference.
But the whole idea of putting shiny things, tinsel, etc., it would have been coins at one point or little scraps of metal or whatever you could find, yeah, that was shiny and bright. That's sympathetic magic. I'm putting this here to create a parallel to the sun, which is getting dimmer and dimmer and colder, because I want the sun to come back next year. So again, that's a very, very old practice. That's way beyond sort of early myths and legends and things. Obviously, they didn't have tinsel.
As you said, coins, bits of metal, things like that. A difference. And it is funny because we do kind of, well, at the very least me, I do tend to think about this sort of period as the time of light. And this is not just, you know, Christian practices. Hanukkah, for instance, lighting of candles.
Yeah.
It's the symbolism of fire and light which appears everywhere. I mean, Diwali as well, there are all these fireworks and things that go on. And it's about that, you know, it can't be coincidence that in these periods of darkness, the celebrations center around light. You need to feed fire. Fire, you know, is dangerous as well. And yet when tamed, when given in small doses, it creates something warm and comforting and protective. It's just, there's nothing quite like lights around winter. And one thing for me, everyone has that thing that makes them feel Christmassy, you know what I mean? And the thing that makes me feel Christmassy, and this is going to sound so lame, but the thing that makes me feel, that's very specifically this winter blue, and it's cold, and then you look up and you see through the windows yellow light pouring out, contrasting this dark blue. And it is like sunlight. It's not white light, it's yellow light. And it's just the most wonderful, comforting feeling in the entire world.
Yeah, I think that's true. On some level, all of us, regardless of religion or creed or what have you, all still kind of worship the sun.
Anyway, let's talk about good King Wenceslasness. Yes.
You know, it used to be one of my favourite... No, I suppose it still is kind of a favourite Christmas carol. It's got such an upbeat tune. You know, in fact, most things where you've got a G major, it's kind of like a nice upbeat tune with a little bit of wistfulness, so it's kind of perfect.
Yeah.
And then you find out who this poor bugger was.
But they're never nice stories.
They're never nice stories. Okay, Good King Wenceslas. There's actually a few contenders, but I've picked the bloodiest because it's the most likely.
Okay.
This is Wenceslas I, the Duke of Bohemia. He was son of Drahmira, the daughter of a pagan tribal chief, and he was a Christian himself. And, you know, this is fairly early Christianity. This is before the Norman conquest, so it's around 940 BC, AD, sorry, after Common Era. Anyway, he did genuinely espouse the idea of if you were in a position to help the poor, then you should do so. So this is where you get the whole Good King Wenceslas thing from. You know, we should provide for each other, we should offer hospitality of our halls and things. And bear in mind, he wouldn't have been a castle of stone or anything back then. We would have been looking at sort of large, long cuts and things like that. Anyway... Most of it was a very mixed bag as to whether the surrounding environs and the other tribes and things were in fact Christian or not. Some of them were, some of them weren't. Some of them really, really didn't like this influx of new religion coming in, telling them what they could do and what they couldn't, and putting restrictions on them, such as you cannot leap over bonfires and have massive orgies and things.
Right.
That didn't please them greatly. And they certainly didn't want one of their leaders being a Christian. Anyway, he was praying outside of a church, and he presumably knew he was going to be murdered, and this was kind of like, okay, the only thing I can do is pray, not because I think I'll be saved, but because it'll give me comfort in my last moments. And he was stabbed repeatedly with a spear and then dismembered.
Oh. Wow.
And... We're once again back on the, okay, we have clearly a decent person, as far as we're aware, being sacrificed, whether it was intentionally or unintentionally.
What a way to go.
Yeah. It does kind of underline the fact that Christianity was not universally embraced by the ignorant pagans, who are kind of like, oh, thank God, a religion that finally makes sense. We've been stumbling in the dark. A lot of it was... No, go or we will kill you.
Yeah.
We're not interested in what you're selling.
Yeah, certainly it was not a, yeah, as you say, not very well embraced, not very well liked. And there were a lot of Christian deaths, a significant amount of Christian deaths. I mean, so much so, it's basically like Christian deaths is lies at the heart of Christianity. You just look at all the saints, the whole point is that they all died horrifically.
I can't remember which Roman emperor it's now who said this now, but he got very frustrated because even though he was doing terrible things to them in arenas and things, they just seemed to go willingly to their deaths, and quite often singing, at least up until the lions got them, yeah. Kind of thing.
Well, I mean,
it's like, why are they so cheerful about this?
Was it Caligula who made Christian candles? He like turned people into living candles for his parties.
Oh. I think that might have been Nero.
Was it Nero? It might have been Nero, you're right.
Caligula did horrible things, but I don't think that was really quite such an issue then.
No.
But you needed a couple more generations before that.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay, which takes us nicely on to wassailing. There's a bit more tree stuff here.
Yay!
The tree stuff is actually the more innocent stuff. Basically, wassailing is not as simple as carolling. In fact, when we talked about carolling, not last year, the year before, carols used to be big circle dances, after which you then went and leapt over a fire and disappeared with a person of your choice into the fields or woods and made the beast with two backs kind of thing, which is why carols were banned from churches for so long. Wassailing is more like the drunken, uncouth cousin of caroling. Let's start off with tree wassailing. Tree wassailing is when you discharge bows and you discharge arrows through a bow, or of late firearms, into a tree in order to ask for a successful harvest next year. So it's a more violent take on the giving a tree a favour kind of thing. So instead of tying ribbons on it, you're discharging bullets into the branches.
I'm sure the tree appreciates.
I mean, it's really... This is kind of the... Instead of asking, you're demanding. And that's at the heart of a wassail.
Yeah.
So then you go on to sort of the door-to-door wassailing that happened, and sort of we're looking at from sort of 1600 onwards. Mm. Certainly for a long time it became a real issue because people go around in gangs wassailing, and it would be like the purge. They would break doors down and they would threaten violence and rape and things unless whoever was there gave them a meal and some money.
I love it because nowadays we just think of like, oh, wassailing, you know, you have all these joyful songs about we shall go a wassailing and stuff like that. And you're like...
It's like, we shall go wassailing. What they're really saying is, yeah, but let's go and break into Squire Hamley's hall and demand money. The weird thing about it was kind of accepted, and we'll get on to Saturnalia in a bit, but it was kind of accepted and not punished quite so rigorously because it was the season of misrule when everything was a little bit topsy-turvy. Mm. So you ideally didn't want someone to think you had a lot of money so they would break into your house.
Yeah. Or if you did, yeah, you wanted guards.
Yeah, it used to erupt in violence. So, yeah, it's not sort of here we come a-wassailing amongst the leaves so green.
Yeah. It always makes me think about, because the whole wassailing thing, it makes me think about its connection with Halloween as well, with trick-or-treaters. Yeah. But also, it always makes me think about Marie Lloyd.
Yeah.
Because what is that about?
Well, it's a similar thing, isn't it? Because I think with the Marie Lloyd, it's, don't they stand on your doorstep and if they basically sing a riddle to you and you have to sing the answer back.
Yeah.
And you have to keep this up until either you can't answer a riddle, in which case you have to let the Marie Claude and the rest of the gang in and feed them,
yeah,
or until you come back with a riddle that they can't answer, in which case they have to go to another house.
Yeah. Which is... Can you imagine how if gang violence worked like that? We're here to take over your territory through the art of riddle.
But first, answer me these riddles three. See, I'm up for that because I think I'd be quite good at the riddle. And it's slightly more civilised than I'm going to break down your door and possibly rape your wife unless you give me a bowl of stew.
Yeah. Oh, dearie me.
Okay, so yeah, while we're talking about very dubious, very, very dubious interactions with people, let's look at the Nutcracker, which is generally celebrated as a very, very Christmassy story. And obviously there's a beautiful ballet.
Yeah.
It's from a story called Der Nussknacker und das Mauskönig. And it's actually based on a much, much older Bavarian legend. Are we surprised?
No.
which represents a seasonal marriage between winter, in this instance a man, an old man, an older man rather, mm-hmm, and spring, who is traditionally a young girl. Mm. Now, the Nutcracker itself is a really disturbing story, because obviously if you actually read the rewritten fairy tale, it goes in some weird places, and I swear that guy was on laudanum. Because it's like, this plot is all over the shop. This is like reading The Phantom of the Opera. You know, it's that nuts. But the actual story is about a young girl who is so startled that she gives herself a really nasty cut on the arm when she dreams about a nutcracker coming to life. And as she's lying in bed sort of recuperating from this, I think it's either her grandfather or the family friend, mm-hmm, called Drosselmeier, who sits with her and, you know, he's talking to her about the kingdom where a prince who'd upset a witch got turned into an ugly nutcracker. Mm-hmm. And the girl insists that if, you know, she insists that someone being as ugly as a nutcracker wouldn't actually stop her from wanting to marry him. Mm. And then in the night, she's abducted to the land of toys where she meets the nutcracker and is forced into a marriage. She seems to be going along with this, okay, but let's bear in mind that when this starts, she's 7 years old and she marries the nutcracker a year later. She'd have been eight, so that's like, yeesh. Already. Now, I realise, as I've said, this has got its roots in the seasonal marriage of winter and spring. So, yes, you would have represented it in a story as a young girl, hopefully not an eight-year-old girl, though, and an older man, so someone in their mid-20s. And before everyone's going yick and is about to yeet this entire podcast into outer space, I'd like to point out that in the medieval era, sort of 16-year-old girls marrying men in their mid-30s or 40s was not that unusual, and that was a relatively okay age difference.
Yeah.
However, the entire thing is just really yick.
Yes.
All the way through. And even when they've tried to sanitise the nutcracker years later, they've kind of made it worse, because instead of the nutcracker being sort of... The nutcracker becomes a complete victim. Mm. As in, he's like, doesn't really want to marry Clara or anything. He's just kind of like, he has no other choice.
Yeah.
And she owns him. She literally owns this nutcracker she's given him for Christmas. And she manages to get the spell released on him and then says, Anne, now you will marry me. And he has no choice in the matter because that's part of the spell. So it's like, someone basically is getting forced into a marriage here. There's a sacrifice going on.
I mean, that is at the heart of a lot of fairy tales.
It is indeed. But yeah, this idea of the sacrifice of your personal freedom or the person you once were through sex and marriage being a euphemism for sex in this case, mm-hmm. is definitely a very wintry story.
Yeah. I don't like nutcrackers.
They are kind of creepy.
They're very creepy. They don't mean well.
Yes.
Okay. Alright. Now, I really, really want to talk about the Lord of Misrule.
Okay. Go ahead.
Okay, well, I said I really want to talk about it. I want you to talk about it. But the Lord of Misrule, again, this is one of those ones where I'd only vaguely sort of knew about it until Jules introduced it in a story.
Yeah, you have Lords of Misrule at different times of the year, yeah. And the Christmas Lord of Misrule is slightly different to, say, the Lord of Misrule you might get on May Day,
yeah.
For example. But let's talk about the winter one.
Yeah.
This all comes from the Roman festival of Saturnalia. Now, we know the Romans really used to like their drinking and their orgies.
Yes.
They also used to do things where they role reverse. So for that particular festival, masters and slaves would switch places.
Yeah. We've got a real sort of carnivalesque thing going on here.
Definitely. The wealthy were encouraged to give gifts to the poor to avoid violence and robbery. So again, a bit like wassailing.
Mm-hmm.
During this time of misrule, if you like, it was considered okay to demand things from people rather than simply ask for gifts.
Yeah.
So really, you know, the exchange of Christmas gifts and things is really quite civilised by comparison.
It really is, yes.
But yeah, the whole point of Saturnalia was uninhibited drinking, sex and excess. And I think a lot of it comes down to this idea of, you know, when you're shut up in the winter and you've presumably had a hard year of work, you need this cathartic release.
Yeah.
Not necessarily in the form of an orgy, although that seems to be where the Romans went with it.
That's usually where the Romans went with it.
Yeah. But they also used to release criminals and allow them to run rampant, which seems like
terrible idea, really.
Stupid thing to do. Yeah. Anyway, we do get Lords of Misrules and things. You've even got some of the universities in Oxford where they still elect their own sort of Lord of Misrule or their boy bishop or whatever. And again, it's that role reversal, that giving power to someone who is comparatively powerless. Mm. Now, St. John's College in Oxford started electing a Christmas prince. The idea of the Christmas prince was he would make sure that this misrule, these excesses and things wouldn't get too far out of line, because sometime during the 17th century, the students got so drunk they nearly burned down an entire building. Now, these were all the sons of very powerful politicians or very wealthy people, and the faculty couldn't afford to offend them. So what they got around it with the idea that they would bring up the whole Lord of Misrule thing, except they'd call him the Christmas Prince, mm-hmm. and put him in charge, because if it became his responsibility to keep things in hand, then they could punish this one person
yeah.
with impunity.
Yeah.
In general, the person who was the firstborn who was chosen got wind of it and thought, fuck that, and ran because he didn't want it. So they re-elected and they tried to give it to another boy, and he was kind of like, oh, I don't want it either. He tried to run and he was apprehended trying to get out of St. John's College grounds, brought back, forced into the robes and sworn in. And they still elect one every year now. I don't think anyone's ever tried to escape since those first couple.
Yeah, it's this idea of, okay, we will allow you to misbehave a little bit on the understanding that you keep it under control, as it were.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yes. That was I'm wondering if there are people out there who read my books and are kind of like, what the hell is happening in book 5 now? How have you managed to get these things in there?
It's glorious, and I love it. So yes, remember, as you're exchanging your Christmas presents this Christmas, at one time it would have just been a massive orgy and you desperately trying to bribe the poor so that they didn't break into your house and eat you.
Ah, the good old days.
Now let's talk about breaking and entering.
Yes, obviously Madeline did not make that to sound like an aspirational thing.
It's time, guys.
It's time for the Dissecting Dragons practical edition. So obviously every year most children are hoping for one very specific burglar to turn up in their house and reverse rob them by leaving presents behind. But the idea of someone coming down your chimney is not restricted just to Father Christmas or Santa Claus. And there's a whole host of horrible supernatural beasties who are apparently allowed to come down your chimney and torment you on Christmas Eve.
This is the thing, right? Because we have so many sort of nice things on Christmas Eve, and then there are all these really nasty things on Christmas Eve. Like in the previous episode, we were talking about, you know, the Yule lads and stuff like that, who just yeah. come in to steal things from you or eat you if you're not wearing Christmas clothes and stuff.
It's the Christmas clothes thing, or the you're not enjoying Christmas enough.
Into the bag you go.
Most upsetting. Yeah, I mean, there's lots of you can. There's so many, I'm not even going to list them, I'm afraid. But the ones that get me in particular, I'm afraid I cannot remember the Greek name, but there's a very specific type of goblin who, in Greek tradition, come down your chimney on Christmas Eve and basically just sort of imprison you in the house and torture you. Mm. And this is kind of where we get onto Yule logs, because the Yule logs were kind of a druidic tradition, and the idea was that your Yule log for the new year would be kindled from a piece of Yule log left from last year,
yeah.
so that you were continuing, so you had this lovely ritual of fire and light from your 1 year being continued into the next year, etc, etc. So continuation with harvest and family, etc, and everything else. The other sidebar of this is it was to stop evil things coming down your chimney.
Trying to come down the chimney met with fire, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, if someone's going to come down your chimney, then having a fire lit in the fireplace is quite a good deterrent,
good idea, yeah.
usually. but yeah, the actual Yule log itself was supposed to ward off eagles? Ward off eagles, because eagles, eagles are well known for flying down chimneys to torment you on Christmas Eve.
This is just the Prometheus thing instead, as the Prometheus eagle comes down on Christmas to eat your liver.
You know what, there probably is a story about that somewhere. To ward off evil spirits and to enhance luck.
So there we go. Once again. It's all about keeping the bad things away.
Okay, a slight twist on a tradition. Mistletoe. We've obviously talked about mistletoe and its role in the death of Balder quite a bit in the past. And it was originally banned by the early church, the Church of the Celtic Rite, or rather certainly the pre-Catholic church that came after it, because it was sacred to the Druids and there's various sort of practices and things surrounded the use of mistletoe.
Yeah.
And they didn't really want anything to do with that. However, in York Minster, they started in the medieval era holding what they called a mistletoe service. Now, if you were a criminal and you came and stood under the mistletoe, then you could legally and physically, morally, spiritually be pardoned for your crimes. The priest would kiss you on the cheek.
Well, okay. I feel like this is potentially not a great idea.
No, I mean, I think some of these services, the mistletoe service, the one where you're asking for forgiveness, I don't think it's legally binding anymore, strangely enough. I think if you've murdered someone, you go and stand at the mistletoe in York Minster. Actually, that doesn't get you absolved in the eyes of the law.
I have murdered all the people in the village, but I'm stood beneath the mistletoe and I'm very sorry.
But it's something that's still done. I think the thing was, in the medieval era, it was quite easy to fall into outlawry just because you were trying to feed yourself.
Yeah.
And you weren't necessarily murdering someone because you're a serial killer. It was a case of, they're trying to kill me.
Yeah.
Oh, damn, he's dead.
And once again, we do have this concept of the releasing of prisoners and stuff like that.
Yes.
I think this is the other thing. It is very important to remember, as you said, Jules, that in this time, there was a lot of outlawry, which was to do with the fact that people were starving to death, and that there were some very particular and very funny things which were part of the law, such as, poaching. You're on someone else's land and you happen to just be shooting a pheasant or something like that. You could be I mean, even into the 18th century, you could be exported for that. You could be hanged. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, you could. Because everything from everything that was game, as in, so everything from rabbits to deer, was considered the property of either the nobles who owned the land or the king.
Yeah.
Therefore, you, a peasant, could not benefit from it. So peasants very rarely ever tasted meat.
Yeah. Which is just cruel.
That's kind of a problem. And it's fine until you have a bad harvest or until the church takes even more of your crops as tithes or taxes and you're left with absolutely nothing. And at a certain point, I think you get to the, you know what, I think I'm just going to shoot a deer.
Yep. Big old deer, that'll keep us going.
Yeah. So it's not quite the same as... As I've gone round and I've murdered an entire monastery of monks or anything.
Yeah. Yeah, I somehow feel like that they probably wouldn't get to the mistletoe.
It is, however, from Norse tradition, considered very ill luck to refuse to kiss somebody under the mistletoe, which I feel is something that's really open to poor interpretation.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like, potential sexual predator lurking under the mistletoe.
That's the thing, though. It's like, put mistletoe in doorways. And I'm always like, no. Put mistletoe somewhere where people want to go stand underneath it. Not, so that every time the postman arrives, I'm like, uh-oh.
The poor sod gets assaulted.
Yeah. That's not game. That's not on.
Okay, a very, very brief mention to Krampus.
Ah!
Because we didn't mention him last week. We probably should have mentioned him last week, because he's kind of like the anti-Father Christmas.
He is. And I think the funny thing about Krampus as the anti-Father Christmas is that it completely ignores the fact that, like, old traditional Father Christmas was Krampus as well.
Yes.
It's not that there was two individual things. It was, you got a present if you behaved well, and if you behaved badly, you went into the sack.
And off to hell with you. Yeah, and then they divided them, and the whole idea of a naughty and a nice list, well, we know that was from Odin, which we'll get into in a moment, yeah. But the whole naughty and nice thing, they used to send Krampus out before Christmas Eve in order to remove all the naughty children so that Father Christmas wouldn't give presents to naughty children. And as you say, it was into the sack and off to hell.
It's so cruel.
Krampus is terrifying. And the other thing about Krampus was he was watching you from the minute you were born.
Yeah, that's not at all scary.
That's so disturbing. It's like, I hate this elf on the shelf thing.
Yes. But, I mean, the idea of like a what was it, you know, an observation state, or I'm using the wrong words, but, you know, a surveillance state where you're constantly being watched. It's not exactly new, is it? And the whole the elf on the shelf thing, I really don't like it. I mean, it's been recorded to result in very odd behaviours in children.
Yes, definitely.
It is creepy, and I mean, the elf on the shelf is creepy anyway. If you just look at it, it looks terrifying. So don't like it. Not at all. Not in the least. But it isn't a new concept. A lot of people saying, oh, you know, it's all about the surveillance state. No, the whole idea of being watched all year round, we have it with Krampus, and then before that we do have it with Odin.
Yes, we do. Which is a good one to get onto the actual origins of Yule itself. We say Yule, and we've kind of adopted the holiday, but originally it was a Norse festival, because one of Odin's other names was Yulfather, which is literally Yulfather.
Yeah.
So it was his feast. So in midwinter you would have this big feast, you would make merry. You actually had to put real effort into making merry in case Odin turned up.
Which he
and
did.
He absolutely had a list of naughty and nice. Which he did, yes, he used to turn up. If you were not celebrating hard enough, then you used to... there were quite severe consequences.
Where's your Christmas spirit? Right.
It's like, forget all that sort of like... you will be haunted by three spirits and we'll see if you change your mind. This was, oh right, so you're only drinking one mug of mead tonight, are you? Right, okay, that's it. Enjoy your death.
Death to you. Once again, we're back to the murder.
So, yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, again, it feeds into the whole tradition of people like to get very drunk, apparently, around Christmas. In every culture, almost, everyone's getting really, really pissed around Christmas and making merry, etc. And there's clearly some violence happening as well.
Mm.
Which, you know, is quite depressing if you think about it.
Yes.
But the idea that... I mean, okay, I get the whole Odin might turn up is basically, are you following the hospitality laws? Because it's more important for you to follow them in winter than any other time.
Yeah.
And that kind of does make sense.
Yeah.
But this is to the nth degree.
It is to the nth degree. And yeah, as we've said in previous episodes about how Odin would just show up at your door in disguise. And if you abided by the hospitality laws and let him in, then, you know, you would be rewarded. And if you didn't, then you went on a list and you didn't want to be on that list. And he knew exactly what was happening.
And this is what's... he knew. There are a lot of... I mean, we said in the previous episode, you know, that Odin may well have been the original Father Christmas. Not St. Nicholas at all. And the more you read about it, the more it's like, actually, he really is the candidate and Father Christmas is a lot grimmer than you think. Okay. One last one. This is... a weirdly chilling one. This is, I'm going to use the word Anglo-Saxon. Anglo-Saxon is not really an accurate word basically it's an old in base is it's a proto a pre-Norman a pagan pre-Norman people's tradition called Modronicht. That's the night of the mothers, and it was a Christmas Eve generally celebration that revered the spirits of women.
Mm-hmm.
So it was the Dísir. The Dísir were female spirits who may well have been harvest and fertility goddesses at some point in time. And the idea was that you revered and honoured them on this night. Mm. One of the things that could potentially happen was young people from the village were rounded up and sacrificed.
Here we go again. I mean, how young are we talking?
Oh, we're talking youths.
Yeah, as in...
We're talking... You know, that's the thing with sacrifice. You don't sacrifice the old shoe that you don't want anymore. You sacrifice the new shoes that you really do, because otherwise it's not a sacrifice.
Yeah.
So, generally, it was a selection of young men. Sometimes this sacrificial event didn't mean blood spilling. It just meant you got a handful of young men and young women and put on a kind of sex orgy type thing.
Great.
So again, it was a big fertility rite, and that was how you honoured the Dísir. There's something a bit sinister about it. We don't really know enough, but it was likely a sacrificial event, and there was likely, you know, animal sacrifice at least.
Mm. That is actually kind of terrifying. It's, you're right, it is chilling that, I mean, a lot of these stories are.
It is... We're back to blood on the snow again, aren't we? So
yeah.
This one we don't know very much about, but it's worth thinking about. And I think that there's more investigation going into it now. There's still a lot of texts and things that haven't been translated.
Mm.
So there could be more coming.
There you go then. So I think we've... we've reached the end of our harrowing list. And the only conclusion I can draw is that I'm actually jolly glad Merry that Christmas. We we celebrate in the way that we celebrate currently.
I think it's always worth knowing what the origins of something are.
Yeah.
Because it's worth knowing how far you've come.
Yeah.
For one thing.
Absolutely.
And, you know, when you're stuck with perhaps relatives that are driving you a little bit mad at Christmas, it could be worse.
You could be being sacrificed or haunted.
I say this very tongue-in-cheek, because I know while some people love Christmas, there are other people who find it harrowing just in and of itself as it is, because they're forced into close confines with family they don't get on with, etc.
Yeah.
And if you're one of those people, I really feel for you, and maybe our bloodthirsty little episode has provided some comfort, and if that's the case, then obviously we'd love to hear from you.
Yes. And of course, this is also a great conversation starter for the dinner table when everyone's trying to make jolly. Oh, isn't your Christmas tree lovely? Yeah, it is. Let me tell you about Christmas trees.
There's something very cathartic, I think, if you're someone who particularly doesn't get on with Christmas, knowing that actually Yule, Midwinter, and even Christmas itself doesn't really have that much to do with goodwill to all men in its most base form. It's got its roots firmly soaked in some very bloody ground indeed.
Yeah. And yet at the same time, it is also a season, as we've said before, of coming together in order to survive. The exchanging of stories, the use of fire as protection and light and hope, the exchanging of gifts, you know, elation, joy, a little bit of excess as a form of catharsis. You know, all of these things are still intrinsically part of Christmas as well.
Yes, absolutely. And this is going to be actually going out on Christmas Day, so... We should, when we wrap up in a moment, I'll take this bit out.
That's okay.
But we should actually say Merry Christmas, etc.
Yeah, we should. So really, on that note, there's nothing more than... Let me try that again. So really, on that note, there's nothing more to say except that we wish you a Merry Christmas, a joyous Yule, a happy Hanukkah. It will have passed, but we hope you had a great one, or whatever you happen to be celebrating, whether it is just a nice a nice winter huddled in on your own. We really hope that it is joyful and full of light and happiness for you. Before we go, it is time for our Dissecting Dragons recommendation of the week. And this week, Jules, I believe that you've got one for us.
Yes, I've just read Piranesi by Susanna Clarke. Susanna Clarke obviously wrote Jonathan Strange and Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell.
When did he get a doctorate?
Mr. Norrell, sorry. It went out of my head completely then. I don't know when he got his PhD, but, you know, he has read every book about magic in England, so it's possible. Anyway, Piranesi is much, much smaller. So, you know, if you found the size of her first novel a little bit off-putting, this one might be a bit more manageable. It's also got a much smaller cast of characters. It is about a young man called Piranesi who dwells in what appears to be a labyrinth, except he calls it the house. And as far as he's concerned, the house is also the world. It's this huge, huge place with thousands and thousands of rooms and halls and vestibules, etc. And somewhere in the lower reaches of the house, an ocean washes in and occasionally causes floods and things. And it's full of classical structures and statuary and things like that. And he seems very happy with himself, as in he's just happy to just be. His big goal in life is to see as much of the world as possible, this house. There's one other person who Piranesi refers to as the other, who is less happy with himself and has an ambition to discover secret knowledge which he's convinced is buried in the house. Piranesi is a complete innocent and is happy to help him with his scientific experiments and things. And then it gets, I wouldn't say I found it mind-bending, but I can see why other people have said that they did. Because a lot of this is about internal versus external reality. I don't want to give you any spoilers, but just to say that there is something very compelling about this story. And even though a lot of the time Piranesi himself is such an innocent that he kind of almost fits being an insufficient narrator, the reader is kept very firmly in the know of what's going on. And it's just kind of reveal after reveal after reveal. Don't expect something like Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell. It's not quite like that at all. But it is definitely a really interesting read.
Thank you very much. That's very interesting. I shall definitely have to check that out. And on that note, guys, we will say thank you very much for listening. Once again, very Merry Christmas. Joyous Yule. And we will catch you guys next week.
Yeah, Merry Christmas. Bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note, no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.